Welcome back to Presidents and Politics. I am one of your hosts, Professor Caleb McGee, joined by my fellow co-host, former Congressman Ross.
Good morning.
Today is an interesting one. We're going to talk about William Howard Taft. And coming off of the heels of Teddy Roosevelt, I don't want to use the word letdown. That's not really fair.
It's like the person who's going to follow Nick Saban as a coach, you know?
That's fair.
I mean, you've got a guy like Teddy Roosevelt who just transformed the offices of the presidency, really did so much for the United States. Who's going to follow him? His hand-picked successor, William Howard Taft.
I like that you bring this up because, honestly, Taft was not that bad. He's a brilliant guy.
Very brilliant guy.
And I think a constitutionalist, as we were talking about before the podcast started, he strict adherence to the Constitution, which I appreciate. And honestly, if you were to take Taft out of history and put him in any other time period, he would probably be seen as a success. For example, if you were to run Taft in 2024, he would probably look like a genius, right?
True.
But putting him in the modern day era, coming off the heels of Teddy Roosevelt, I cannot think of many presidents in history, many men in history, who could have come on the heels of Teddy Roosevelt and seemed to be a success with someone who is so much larger than life than Teddy Roosevelt. Like, how do you follow a man like that unless you are like him? And there's not too many people in history that
no,
like
and,
him.
No, and the insult to it all, of course, is Roosevelt coming back under the Bull Moose Party and running against him and outgaining him significantly in the Electoral College, still losing the race.
And splitting the Republican vote.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is an interesting...
Happened before.
Uh-huh.
You know,
could
Ross Perot,
again.
Yes.
Yep. And it could happen on the 2024 election on either side, right? The Democrat
True.
Or the Republican, a vote could be split. And we see this happening throughout history. And typically when a vote is split, the other party wins. So,
correct.
And I think we've talked about this, that's kind of a strategy sometimes the opposing party will use is to raise, if you will, a strawman candidate in
yes,
order to split
the vote.
Is that even legal, by the way? Is that
It is. In Florida, they outlawed it because that's what happened to me when I ran for Congress the first time in 2010. Some Democrats got together and created the Florida Tea Party and recruited conservatives or were purported conservatives to dilute the Republican side of the ticket as a third party. The legislature then addressed this and said you have to be a political party for at least 1 year
Interesting.
In order to qualify for an election in the state of Florida. So the states are now addressing that. But on a national basis, you know, an independent can run anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, they don't have to be a party affiliate.
Mm. Interesting. So that could lead to some very underhanded strategies of politics.
Oh, yeah.
Which, I mean, kind of goes hand in hand a lot of times.
Yeah. Well, it's politics.
It's politics, right? But Taft... typically, if you ask the average American, first of all, they might not know who Taft is. But if they do know who Taft is, it's always basically like he's the most rotund president, right?
Yep, nearly 300 pounds.
Yeah, I think he got to 350 during his like binge time because there was a time period when Roosevelt goes against him and all this, and he's just really having a hard time. He's a stress eater, so he actually will
yeah, I read somewhere
gain
where
up.
he would have a breakfast of a dozen eggs, a pound of bacon, and pancakes, and then just be lethargic the rest of the day because he just ate so much.
It sounds like a powerlifting diet for those of us who were like, that's like bulking phase, right?
That's a week's worth of breakfast in one day.
That's bulking phase days,
yeah.
Okay? But the problem is I don't think he was necessarily going to the gym to lift.
I don't think he was.
I mean, if you're in the gym lifting, you can call that, dirty bulking and get away
yeah.
with that. But if you're not going to the gym, you probably can't really call that anything. Interesting guy, though, has a very interesting childhood, comes from a family of overachievers.
Yeah, his father was Attorney General under Ulysses Grant, was
yes.
an ambassador.
Yes.
You know, yeah, he was exposed to government and law at an early age, and I think he had an affinity for law, but he married a wonderful woman who had whose father was a political activist from the
yes.
Republican Party, and her determination was being first lady.
She wanted the office more than he did.
Oh, yes.
That's very fair to say. I remember reading a political commentary years ago that made the statement that had women been able to run at this time period, she would have run in the first place anyway, right?
Like I believe
she
that.
Would, and I agree
yeah.
too. Like she was the one who had her eyes in the White House, not necessarily him. In fact, later, as we'll get into this, he became the Supreme Chief Justice of the Supreme
yeah.
Court, only person who ever did that, who held both the presidency and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Right.
And he said that he loved the Chief Justice much more than the presidency. In fact, so much so that at the end of his life, he said he could barely even remember being president.
Yeah.
I mean, he just
but
didn't care.
But what he did, he transformed the Supreme Court, too, because up until that time, the Supreme Court would hear cases in the Capitol
their,
building.
Their House and Congress showing
yeah.
their dependency upon Congress. Oh,
correct. And his involvement, you know, was able to get the funding for the construction of the U.S. Supreme Court that
beautiful
exists
building
today.
Anyway,
absolutely
by the way.
Beautiful.
Amazing building. But one of the things he said, which I like this, he had a bright mind.
Oh,
it's
yes.
all that protein, right, of all
yeah.
the eggs every morning. But nonetheless, what he said was that building a physical structure would show show in concrete terms the reality that the judicial branch was its own standard, standalone branch. That way,
correct,
in physical terms, you could see the legislative branch, the executive branch, and the judicial branch, and that for too long, the judicial branch being housed inside the Capitol made it look as if it was dependent upon Congress, and it needed its independency to be shown as a separate, standalone branch so all three could be seen as national monuments. And honestly, that seems like a psychological game, but it's true.
It is very true, and I think it bodes well for the structure of our government in order to have that perception, because that is reality.
Exactly.
They are three separate branches of government.
Exactly. And the judicial branch cannot be in the pocket of Congress,
no,
as at this time period, in some ways, kind of was leading up to this. In some ways,
yes,
we understand that the Founding Fathers set up that the legislative branch would be, in some ways, the most powerful branch, right?
Like, correct.
We all would agree with that. And throughout the early years of American history, the legislative branch carried, by far, fundamentally, the greatest source of power.
Yes.
By far. Then we see the era of the executive presidential branch, like, streaming to power under Teddy Roosevelt to start with. Taft will back this back some, which is one reason why he's unliked by the progressives, which will break from the Republicans anyway. Then we'll see under Roosevelt's cousin, FDR, the New Deal.
The amazing expansion of the executive office.
Incredibly. And that'll be followed through probably not seeing until Lyndon B. Johnson.
Correct.
Again, carried through in a huge way. So now we see the legislative branch was most powerful for a time period. The executive branch becomes most powerful. And I would say in some ways we're coming close to the era of the judicial branch becoming the most powerful. Now we have judges making decisions that impact the legislative and executive branch to a higher level. So maybe it's that constant like struggle for power.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me if you agree with me or not, but I would say that in some ways the judicial branch is trying to raising its head, trying to become the most powerful of the three in the modern era.
Yeah, to some degree, I would say yes. I think it's a constant struggle that the design of our system has been a struggle for the balance of power between the respective branches of government. And so, you know, the Supreme Court has been probably more political than it's been in a while.
Yes.
And that is as a result of Congress.
Agreed. And the executive branch,
and the executive
to some
branch,
extent.
And the executive branch as well. And, you know, when you watch to see they can't create new law. There's some interesting cases that are now being considered by the Supreme Court that would that may overturn earlier precedent. But precedent is what they rely upon in order to give decisions on current issues. But they hold the power to reverse their own precedent,
mm-hmm,
which is interesting.
It is.
You know,
and I like that you said that, because if we're staying true constitutionalists, and Taft was, to the true ideal of the court system, as you said, the Supreme Court has the freedom to interpret the law, but they do not have the freedom to legislate the law.
Correct.
And I think that the modern American misses that. If you look at some controversial rulings in the past, or specifically some things that have just taken place, everyone constantly looks at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is not to legislate law. The Supreme Court is to interpret law.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, again, Justice Taney in the Dred Scott decision, who says that African Americans can never be American citizens. You know, of course, that's absurd. It's unconscionable, and that
yes,
was eventually taken care of by the 13th and 14th
absolutely
Amendments. But then again, you also see what's happening here with Taft, that he's the only one that has both the executive power and the judicial power as Supreme Court justice. And lastly, you know, the Roe versus Wade decision that was overturned by the Dobbs decision 2 years ago. I mean, that's a change of judicial precedent. There was no legal basis in
that's
the
right
Constitution to protect abortion.
That's right.
It was interpreted by those justices that sat and considered that the Roe decision way back in the 70s. Now you got a different makeup of the court, and they say, well, let's look at this. Did they rely on constitutional construction, and where in the Constitution does it give a right of privacy or protection for abortion? They determined that it doesn't, and that comes up with the Dobbs decision and says this should then be left to the states for consideration, and that's what's happening now, is that the states have been delegated the authority to determine whether they're going to regulate abortions
or not. I like where
not
you're going with this, because the court is not to be the court of public opinion.
Correct.
The court is to interpret the laws that have been passed by Congress, and of course the chief law being the Constitution, which is where the right and the power of Congress has to even to legislate in the first place. And we have this idea that somehow the Supreme Court is to hear the popular opinion of the people, and then they're to somehow carry out the will of the people. They're not to carry out the will of the people.
No.
And I've even heard colleagues and peers about controversial cases. They'll be like, well, can't they see what the popular opinion of the people is? That doesn't matter. What matters is that they're to carry out the rule of law, and they're to interpret the Constitution. They're to interpret law. They're not to carry out the public opinion of the masses.
Correct.
They're in some ways they're not a representative form of government. They are simply an interpretive form of the legal documents and precedents that's here.
Hence, and I judicial think review.
We lose that, which we don't teach civics anymore in school. So we expect.
Amen to that. But, like, and the independence of the judiciary is absolutely
the
crucial.
The apolitical nature of the judiciary is fundamental, and we're losing that.
Yes, we are.
We need to get back to that. No matter what side of the aisle you're on, if you're on the right or the left,
you want an objective.
We
judiciary.
Want an objective because the whole entire format of the American government is that. We're going to have power shifts. In fact, we teach in political science that in order to have a healthy democracy, you have to have a shift in power at least every 10 years. We get that. What you don't want is you don't want your court to begin being influenced by that shift in power every 10 years. You want that court to be able to rule off of the rule of law, not off of political influence.
Correct. And speaking of Taft, you know, I mean, again, as a jurist, when he is given the assignment of taking over the Philippines, he drafts their constitution.
Yes.
He becomes their first governor.
And he's beloved by the people.
He's beloved by the people, and he treats them in a very humanely fashion that they weren't used to.
Yes.
But he says it will take a while before they can gain their independence, and it does. They don't gain their independence until 1946, some 40 years later.
So much so that when he is the governor of the Philippines after the Spanish-American War, because, of course, we win the Philippines.
Right.
We win.
Yeah, we take Guam.
I don't know if that's the right way to word that.
Yeah.
We acquire the Philippines through the Spanish-American War, and actually Teddy Roosevelt, which McKinley first, then Teddy Roosevelt, both ask Taft to come serve in different roles.
Yes.
And the first time when he's asked to come serve in a different role, the people of the Philippines begin to basically like protest, like, don't leave us, we trust you so much. And Taft has such a soft heart that he says, okay, I won't go take a better position back in D.C. I'll stay here and oversee and help the people of the Philippines. He's a good guy.
He's a very good guy. He was also, I guess, the provincial governor of Cuba at one time, too. You know, I mean, he
get was a big caring, heart.
He did. You know, he did. And the one thing about him that just really amazes me is how he tried to appease both sides of the party that got him there. And then when he realized he couldn't, he chose the side that he chose the more conservatives and not the progressives that put him there.
Yeah.
And he really upset Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes.
Was it Gifford Pinchot, the forestry director, which was then now the Department of Interior, mm-hmm. that he then fires. And undoes what, you know, Roosevelt thinks is some of the greatest things that he's done for conservation, which was.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's – I mean, the myths about him are amazing, you know, that he got stuck in a bathtub.
Yes.
You know, which I couldn't find any truth to that.
Yeah. And what's interesting is there's actually some credible sources that still say – there's no primary sources.
No.
I think the other myth was what, he was buried in a piano box.
Yeah.
There's so many – he's like –
There's a myth that he created the seventh inning stretch.
Yes, I've read this.
But when in actuality, he was just standing up because he was so heavy and tired.
Yes.
In the seventh inning that everybody stood up with him because they thought he was leaving.
And he's the president. When the president stands, everyone stands,
everybody
right?
Everybody stands.
When the president enters the room, you stand. So I guess in some ways he could have set the precedence for the seventh inning stretch, which he's a massive baseball fan.
Yes.
Which, I mean, I guess this is an appropriate time of year to talk about this, right?
Yes.
But, I mean, come on. It's a good time of the year. But he's a massive baseball fan. Plays second base in high school. I guess it's really not truly high school, but at league back then. They didn't really have school sports. But all throughout his childhood, he loves baseball. Plays second base. Was a power hitter. I guess in today's time, he'd probably been like a DH, right? He's a power hitter.
Big boy.
I mean, he's a big boy. But they said he was a poor runner because of this. So I guess in today's time, he'd been like the DH or the mercy runner waiting on, just get the first base. If you can make it to first base, we got someone for you, right?
Yep.
And we all have guys like that on our team.
Oh,
we understand. And this was basically who Taft was. He sets the precedence for throwing out the first pitch.
Yes, he does.
He's the very first.
So
on April 14th, 1910.
Look at you.
I'm a baseball guy. You know this. You are too. He throws the very first pitch for the National Senators.
Yeah.
And what's
against
interesting,
the Philadelphia Athletics, I think.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is back then, the president didn't come to the mound and throw the first pitch. He would throw the pitch from the stands to the pitcher, and the pitcher would throw the pitch to the catcher. And he's the first to do this. And I'm trying to think of the first president who came to the mound. It might have been George W. Bush, who actually came to the mound and threw full, 90 feet. He's, I think, the first to do that.
I think you're right.
And then this has been a precedence that has been carried out for almost 100 years.
Yes.
The last two presidents have not carried this through. But up until then, this had been a precedence for almost 100 years that as a president, you would throw out a pitch on opening day for the National Senators. And I love this tradition. We need to bring it back, honestly.
Well, let me just tell you, from my experience, because being in Congress, you get invited to a lot of baseball games. I would get invited to spring training games, both, you know, over the Yankees in Steinbrenner Field, and they would ask me to throw out the first pitch. And look, I played baseball. One of the most nerve-wracking things is standing on that mound and knowing that you've just got to make it 90 feet, and you know you can, But you just wonder if, you know, fortunately, I was able to do that the couple of times I did it. But it is very nerve-wracking.
You need to go see, like, a sports psychologist first.
You practice that because you just don't want it to one hop. You don't want it to go over their head. You don't want it to go around them.
Right. And you don't want to be on the news because being that politician.
Yes.
And can you imagine the heckling that's going to take place?
Absolutely.
Of the entire nation saying, we voted this guy in.
It doesn't have to be a strike. It just has to get there.
Lob in the air. Just lob you underhand at that point. I mean, softball at that point. But yeah, so he's a massive baseball fan. Like you said, he starts this tradition. And I don't think we're off topic here because Taft, in many ways, is a unifier, right? He wants to unify people. And one of the classes I teach here is sports and international relations. And there is a unifying element to sports. And we can all agree with that. If it's the national level, if we look at things like the Super Bowl, or the World Series, or the international level, where you look at things like the Olympics. There's something about sports that can unify people, and I think we're losing even that. Look at the Super Bowl this last year, and how divisive it became, if you will, about all the random conspiracy theories floating around. Where we're taking unifying elements, and we're even making those elements controversial. It shows you where we are in our discourse of civility at this time period.
Yeah, it didn't used to matter whether you're Republican, Democrat, left or right. As long as you were for the same team, we all got along so great during that sport.
Exactly. And now we're even politicizing sports.
Yeah.
That was never
the
idea behind sports. And I think, again, as we look at Taft, Taft was the kind of guy who he wanted to unify. One of the things everybody talks about with Taft is how just outgoing he was, how friendly he was, how kind he was. And that went a long way until the Republican Party split. And this is interesting. You talked about this. You already touched on this. The Republican Party at this time period will split between the progressives and the conservatives.
Correct.
And if you look at the Republican Party in 2024, in some ways, we're kind of there again.
Oh, yes, we are there.
And it makes you wonder, do you, as someone who's been in the Republican Party for years, do you see a future split coming, or do you think that could be amended first?
Well, it depends on what the results of the election are. If Trump is the nominee, which presumptively he is now, and he wins, then the party restructures around him.
Okay.
For as long as he's around. If he loses, the party then probably becomes more not anti-Trump, but renews itself with some of the old guard.
Can we use the term moderate?
Yeah,
the party
more
becomes
moderate,
more moderate in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
What about the Democrat Party? Because they're facing the same.
I think the exact
hurdles.
Same thing.
Okay.
I think the exact same thing. I mean, you've got two octogenarians. Running for office. And that's why
they're not throwing the first pitch out. That 90 feet,
right.
That 90 feet is a long way. Okay. That's where we do need the slow pitch.
That's right.
The lob, right?
Give me a pitching machine.
Hey, they could just turn it on.
Exactly.
So Taft, by the way, he is an overachiever, although, again, we don't – he's in so much in the shadow, ironically. He's so much in the shadow of
Roosevelt. Because he cast a big one, yes.
He cast a big one. But he's so much in the shadow of Roosevelt that we forget a lot of his accomplishments. He is a judge by the age of 29.
Yes.
Today's, like, delayed adolescence, I mean – most Americans don't even know what they're going to do for the rest of life by the age of 29. He's already graduated from Yale. Where did he go to law school? I'm trying to remember. His undergrad was Yale. Law school was Ohio, right? Where is that? Wherever he went to law school.
Yeah.
It wasn't Columbia because that's New York. Where did he go to law school? Anyway, graduates from law school, and he already has been a lawyer and is already a judge.
University of Cincinnati.
Thank you. I knew it was Ohio. So the University of Cincinnati, and he already is a judge by the age of 29.
Isn't that amazing?
And he's still – when you read his biographies, they said he was already kind of, if I can use the term, neurotic, that he was already feeling like he was an underachiever compared to his family. He's a judge.
I know.
By 29. He's not even turned 30 yet. He's already a judge.
Yeah. And then he becomes a federal district judge.
Yes.
You know, which is amazing. And then he becomes Secretary of War.
Yes.
You know, I mean, the guy
Governor
had a
of the
lot
Philippines.
Of, and the one thing, he really opened up the dollar diplomacy.
I was fixed to touch on dollar diplomacy. I'm glad you're getting into this.
Go ahead. I think, you know, it still exists today.
Yes.
I mean, you've got China do it in their Belt and Roads Initiative. You know, we still do it. You know, we do it within the Middle East and whatnot. But it wasn't as successful him as I think he wanted. He, you know, figured we would use dollars instead of bullets to try to gain peace and to help, you know, democracy thrive in South America, and that kind of backfired on them.
It's an interesting concept, and I do agree with it to an extent. So it's kind of an Adam Smith ideal in the sense that you can control the world more through trade than you can through fear.
Absolutely.
And I agree with that.
I strongly believe this day.
There's more power in building a strong ally and then trading with them and then trading with you and then using sanctions than there is about simply using what colonialism. Maybe in some ways, this is the we saw colonialism didn't work. So the rebirth of that is the idea of dollar diplomacy.
Correct.
I think that's fair to say.
Yes. And the consumers in these foreign countries, once they become accustomed to having better goods and services at competitive prices, they want the dollar diplomacy. They want this trade going back into.
So could we call this economic colonialism?
I think it was an attempt at it.
Yeah,
yes,
it's in a way it's economic colonialism. If that makes sense to our listeners, I really think that is. And if you look at modern day global geopolitics, there is a decrease in the power of the American dollar and the usage of the American dollar globally, and there's the increase in other markets. And you have to ask yourself, how is that going to affect our political standing in the future?
Yeah, but consider this also, that at the time that this was going on, the Taft's desire to have international trade with the United States being the economic engine of it, mm-hmm. was to allow us to raise tariffs because that was our source of income.
That's right.
We didn't have an income tax.
And the almost complete now,
yes.
too. So think of this massive trade route that was complete because Roosevelt finished it. Was it complete yet? Yeah. So we have this massive trade route now that's going to open up, and the money we're making off of the Panama Canal, so he sees this.
And we can raise tariffs to make more money for the government, but that kind of backfires on us.
And then, of course, he opens up new income tax like never before, too.
Yep. Because the income tax law that came in as a result of the Civil War was declared unconstitutional.
That's right.
So the only way he knew we could get it done is to have it done as a constitutional
that's
amendment.
Right.
So he does the 16th Amendment in 1913, passes a federal income tax, mm-hmm. and that takes the pressure off of tariffs, but mm-hmm. now puts it on the residents of the United States, the income earning.
Which is an interesting concept. Instead of foreign countries paying, now the individual citizens are paying this
Correct.
More. So maybe this is a shift to isolationism before World War I. We're trying to take care of everything internally.
Yeah.
But then we put more of the weight back on our own citizens. People forget that federal income tax is really little over 100 years old. It has not always been.
That's true.
I mean, that
That's
is
true. That, yeah.
That's
fees and tariffs is how we raised money.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've got federal income tax, which. Course, you know, has
which is again, this isn't
complicated
a podcast.
Everything.
No, this isn't a podcast on economics, but it makes you wonder if would it not benefit the American more to pay more for a product on the front end than to pay lesser product and then have to pay a percentage of their overall salary. Because the tariff, you may have to pay more for your tea, your coffee, your sugar, but you're keeping your actual income that you earn versus instead of paying less for a good, but then having a percentage of your overall salary taken from you that way. So which
we had this debate, the flat tax, you know, what do
yes.
you do? You get to keep your income, but you pay a high percentage tax on everything you buy.
Absolutely.
It's consumer driven.
Yes.
You know, if I want that car and I'm going to pay a 30% tax on it, then that's my choice, but at least I get to keep 100% of my income.
So if it's a hard year, I can not buy the car and be able to provide.
Correct.
So,
and you know, that goes back into, you know, we haven't seen it since probably the, 2010 election when it was a big issue.
That was a very big issue.
I know that Governor Huckabee was a proponent of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. It's an interesting standpoint.
Yes.
I don't know how it would work in modern day economic terms, but you never know. Could be.
Put a lot of accountants out of business.
And a lot of tax lawyers.
A lot of tax lawyers, yes.
Volumes and volumes and volumes
of
books.
You keep your income, you just pay your, you know, the user tax.
Yeah,
the
like
user
you said,
fee.
It's a consumer-driven society,
exactly.
Which is an interesting concept. So he is an interesting guy. One of the things, by the way, we talked when he was the governor of the Philippines, he so lobbied for the individual person. I came across this
yes.
a while ago that he actually negotiated with the Vatican, with the Catholic Church, to free up land that the Catholics had taken from the people and then give it back to the people. He actually negotiated, and I can't remember the exact sum of money. It's over $7 million. He frees up 390,000 acres. Which, I mean, the Philippines is a small region was Catholic-owned land and then re-gives it back to the people.
Wow.
So you see the heart of Taft. He really, really does care about the everyman. He cares about the little person. So I like Taft. I think he catches a bum rep. Everyone's just always making him the butt of the jokes because, like, oh, he's a big guy. He gets stuck in the bathtub. That's all you ever hear about Taft.
Yeah.
But he's a really solid human being.
I mean, Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court ain't a bad way to go out of life.
Yeah.
You know,
if any other human being had held the office of both the President of the United States and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, that should be what you're remembered for.
Yes.
But he's remembered for the old American myth of getting stuck in a bathtub.
Yeah.
And you just have to be like, what happened along the way? He needed a better biographer, I guess. I don't know. But we don't think about him for really who he was.
He had the first automobile in the White House.
Yes, he did.
From the White Sewing Machine in Cleveland, Ohio. They had a steam engine. And he bought it. And he transformed the stable at the White House and was driving around in this steam-driven limousine.
Mm-hmm.
I think he had his cow that was milk cow.
I was going to say he's the first president to keep a cow on the White House lawn because he only wanted fresh milk for breakfast. Well, I mean, if you're eating a dozen eggs, you need fresh milk to wash it down.
Probably a high fat content too in that milk.
Again, dirty bulking. Had he hit the gym, this guy could have been massive. I mean, there's a great protein, great fat there, but that's a whole other story. That's my strength coaching side wanting to come out, and we'll leave it at that. So Harding will appoint him after he has the failed reelection, because, mm-hmm. of course, as we've said, he'll run for a second term. Doesn't really even like being president, honestly, at all. His wife likes it, but he doesn't really. And his wife will have a stroke, mm-hmm. so maybe she's not pushing him quite as hard to be president again. So he runs again, and then we have Roosevelt running the Bull Moose Party, which, oh my goodness, we talked a lot about that.
Strong as a bull moose.
Right? That's where the assassination happens during this. So much is going on. The vote is split, and then, of course, you have Woodrow Wilson, who will get in.
Yes.
And Wilson will be the first academic president. He's the only president.
That's
has a PhD. He's the only president in American history who holds a PhD. And in some ways, he's almost, I don't know how to say this, he's almost too academic for the office. Everything's like ethereal for him, which is one of the reasons why he's so afraid to go to war, too. But that's a whole other story. We'll get to him next week.
Yes.
But nonetheless, you have then Harding, after Wilson, will appoint him as the 10th Chief Justice.
Yeah.
And this was the life goal of Taft in so many ways.
He stays there until his death in 1930.
Yeah, which he'll live to be 72?
I think so. I don't
In his 70s, which is actually older.
72,
Roosevelt dies at 60, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, for this time, which, I mean, Roosevelt had been through multiple wars down the Amazon, 2 years in Africa.
Yeah.
He's had malaria. He's been shot. I mean,
that body had put in a lot.
It's not
work.
The years; it's the mileage.
Exactly.
Right. Roosevelt had a lot of mileage. So Taft, faith wise, was with their faith. He's a Unitarian, which in many ways, I guess, for modern day times, would be like he's a deist. So he doesn't believe in the deity of Jesus, but he believes in one true God who's over all things, who's sovereign. And later, when he was asked about his faith, he said, and I quote, "The church is a bulwark against socialism and anarchy." That's just a cool thought. So he's not a Ulysses S. Grant. He's not even a Roosevelt. He's not a John Adams.
No.
He's not one of these guys who's a devout, diehard follower of Jesus. But he sees the value, and this is what I thought about. And I want to talk to you about. He sees the value of the church. So even if he doesn't necessarily believe all of the tenets of orthodoxy, he says the church is one of the strongest social institutions to keep American democracy working. And I like that because we're shifting away from that. In American history, even if you didn't necessarily believe the tenets of orthodoxy, candidates on both sides of the party saw the importance of faith. And I think that's beginning to slide in modern American politics.
Yes, it definitely is. And I remember back in the 50s when Lyndon Johnson was a senator and he offered the Johnson Amendment to the tax code that prohibited anybody from a nonprofit, if you will, from advocating for a candidate or issues. And this was determined that if you're a pastor, you can't preach from the pulpit as to which candidate you should vote for or not. Otherwise, you would lose your
tax-exempt
status. Mm-hmm. That changed the dynamics.
It
and did. I think, you know, and I think what Taft is referring to there is that the church communities were so strong and so healthy and so good. Because remember, this is way before the New Deal.
Yes.
Where you didn't have government programs.
No.
The churches were providing the orphanages. They
Absolutely.
Were providing the
soup kitchens, the bread lines.
Everything.
Yes.
They were the ones. And that was the best defense against anarchy and communism and Marxism. And that's where I think he goes to this. And now you look at today, if it wasn't for the moral majority that was utilized by Ronald Reagan in the 80s, you wouldn't have seen the evangelical movement. And now today, I don't know where it is today. You know, I don't know if it's Christian nationalism versus evangelicalism. I don't know where we are today. But
I'm not sure.
You're not seeing, I don't think, the same type of leadership coming out of our churches as we once did in this nation.
Since time immemorial, it was understood throughout cultures that the strength of a culture came from family units,
mm-hmm.
and then it came from a form of religion, right?
Correct.
Every culture, if you want to go back to the Greeks, if you want to look at the Romans, when they were at their strongest, they recognized the importance of the family and they recognized the importance of religion. And one of the reasons why America has been so strong is because the emphasis we place upon the family unit and the emphasis we place upon our Judeo-Christian values.
Yes.
And our leaders always recognize this throughout American history, whether or not they even accepted those Orthodox beliefs, they recognize the importance of those Orthodox beliefs, as Taft would say, against socialism and anarchy.
Yeah.
And if you look at, which by the way, I love that. It's like it's the two opposite ends of the spectrum, right? And you're saying that the church, the institution of the church has the ability to unify both ends of the spectrum. And if you think about that, that's very true. But we're finding ourselves in a political environment, in a political climate, where that is very quickly dissipating.
It is. In fact, it's almost becoming, you know, unspoken. You shouldn't be wearing your religion on your shirt sleeve if you're going to be in politics.
Keep it to yourself.
Yeah, which I think is absolutely inappropriate.
I agree. And you have to begin to wonder. I always tell my students, 10, 15, 20, 25 years from now, what will society and government look like as a ramification from this new tenet in ideology?
Yeah.
So this has been the life of Taft. Again, so maligned, so the butt of every joke, but a really solid dude.
Yeah. A good person, not a great person.
Not a great person. No, he's not a great person, right?
But a good person.
But he's got a good heart. He's a good man,
yes.
But not necessarily a great man. And next week, we're going to start, I guess, setting kind of the framework for the beginnings of World War I.
Yep.
And the first kind of academic mind president and the belief of isolationism. So there's some interesting things we'll get into next week. This has been Presidents and Politics.
Thank you.